Welcome to the Sports Science Dudes. I am your host, Dr. Jose Antonio, with my co-host, Dr. Tony Ricci. Hey, it is 2024. This is our first show of the year.
How about that, Tech?
We're excited. If you're a first-time listener, hit the subscribe button and like the show. You can find us on YouTube, Rumble, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Our special guest today is Jackie Kaminsky. She is a registered dietitian, nutritionist with an MS degree in exercise phys and sports nutrition from Florida State University, who, by the way, got their asses kicked. Did you see that, Tony?
I did, but those bowl games don't count unless you're in the top four. Let's go
Got
Washington, by the way. I can't root for Harbaugh, but go
Oh, that's true. That's Ohio State's nemesis, right?
You got that right.
All the Florida State people were whining about, oh, we should be in the top four. And then they get shellacked. They get shellacked.
Was that
Anyhow.
your best moment?
Really. More about Jackie. Our first introduction to working with pro athletes was back in 2017, where she worked at the UFC Performance Institute in Las Vegas, Nevada. Since then, Jackie's worked with various professional fighters and other clientele, and now operates under the company she started back in March. The Fight Nutritionist. That's pretty cool. The Fight Nutritionist. It's dedicated to providing the most effective nutrition plans, ensure her athletes are performing at the absolute best. And I'm sure we'll have a lot of, we'll talk a lot about that. You're also a member of the ISSN. You've actually helped with some data collection, got some publications. And when you aren't working, which is, you work most of the time, seems like you travel a lot, Jackie.
I do travel a lot.
You also train in a little bit in kickboxing, Muay Thai, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a pleasure to have Jackie Kaminsky on the show. Welcome.
Hey, thank you.
Hey,
Hey,
go
wait, can I
ahead.
just start? Jackie is speaking this year at ISSN. Am I correct? Let everybody know that.
Well, I know Jackie knows that.
I know that. Yeah. News, recent news, super excited about
All
it.
right. Yes, that would be June 18 to 20 in Bonita Springs, Florida. So if you want to see Jackie's talk, actually also one of our other good friends and colleagues, Corey Peacock, he'll be
Yep.
giving a talk on some of the data we collected from the UFCPI. So
Hey, Corey's talking again. That's a first in a while.
I know it has been a while, huh? We don't
Yeah.
want to tell anyone Corey's secrets for maintaining his composure up there. But anyways, hey, you know what I want to talk a little bit about? You went to Florida State. And I'm a big fan of, sort of funny, ironic stories, right? Here's what's interesting about the world of dietetics. There are conventional dietitians, and then there are people like you. And we all know what that means. That's the funny part. You don't need to explain. We all know what that means. So tell the audience what happened to you while you were going through your master's degree at Florida State. Because you know what? It's kind of funny because look where you ended up. You could sort of, go nan 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 nan. I ended up being quite successful. So tell the audience what happened when you were at Florida State.
Yeah, so we're going to preface this with we're not going to give a shout out to Florida State in any means. They're not responsible for my success. We are not giving them that satisfaction. But yes, the favorite story that you love me to tell. So when I just got back from that UFC internship, and by the way, that was so when I started my internship, our internship director that year left. She just quit
Wait,
unexpectedly.
tell the year. What year is this?
Oh God. Well, I finished. Okay, so if I did the internship in 2017, then that would have been the summer of 2017. So that would have been the fall of 2017. So our internship director left unexpectedly. They had to have an interim, and it was a complete disaster. The lady who filled in, she had no idea what was going on. All the students, we were basically on our own. It was a mess. But I was the first person in the history of Florida State to facilitate that introduction to the UFC. So they didn't have any connections. I'm the one who reached out. I came back. Obviously, it was a great experience. I had glowing, recommendations. They loved me. It was such a great experience. And then come fall 2017, I was starting a new class, advanced metabolism, which was my favorite subject. And the professor who normally taught it also taught the master's level or the graduate level. So I was super excited to take her class again. And then, but that was the first year because they shifted everything that she wasn't teaching that course. and they hired a brand new professor to come in and teach that course. And me being who I am, I'm very skeptical of people.
Hey,
But
that's not a bad thing, actually. That's
oh
not like
no.
it's required.
Yeah. So I was, and she, her bio, you read her bio. She had a really impressive bio, but she was really young. But, and my perception was that, oh, okay, well, maybe she's inexperienced in the teaching realm. Like it was her first year teaching ever, but she's got a really impressive bio, so she's got to be really intelligent. Like she clearly impressed the board or whoever does all the hiring for professors at FSU. Long story short, she came in. She could not teach at all.
Wait, what does that mean? She could not teach at all. Give us like an analogy, like.
She could only read off of PowerPoints,
Oh, that's annoying. That's
word for
annoying.
word. When she was asked questions in the class, she asked other students if they could Google it for her.
No. Wait, this is a grad class.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm like, oh, great. Okay. So my professor can't answer questions. She needs someone to Google it for her. I was like, you can't provide additional insight into a topic that we're learning. That's concerning.
Okay.
And she was just kind of regurgitating all the information that we covered in undergrad. So it was an exact, she also taught the undergraduate sections. And it literally felt like an exact repeat. So fast forward, our whole class filed a complaint because it all started when she failed us on our first exam. So it was carbohydrate metabolism, which anyone who studies carbohydrate metabolism, you cover it in biochem, chemistry, biology, even in metabolism. So when you're going through your curriculum, it's covered so many times that like even if you sucked at metabolism, you still understand carbohydrate metabolism. And she failed everyone on that test. It was a take-home test. We had a week to do
F.
it.
Everyone got an F.
No, the highest grade was a 78. So
And this is, I'm sorry, just written short answer, essay, which.
it was multiple choice and short answer. So I wrote back to her in an email. I complained about my test grade. I, asked her if I could retake it in her class. And, because I'm, a little petty, I attached my undergraduate grade that I got for that course. And put,
I
I have
love this.
mastery in this material, as you can see here.
So immediately she loved you.
She did. She really appreciated that, I think. But fast forward again. So our whole class complained. She got in trouble with the department. She didn't get fired. But, after that, I just think that, because of my email, some of our interactions, she didn't like me. And so after that semester was over, spring semester now come. End of spring, I was getting ready to graduate. So I had summer semester left, which was just internship. So I was coming down to South Florida, moved back home with my parents, start my clinicals, and met with all my major professors, my internship director. Everything was great. A week before I start internship, I get an email from the department saying that I've been temporarily misplaced from the program because,
Oh.
and they reached out to my internship director, let them know that I wouldn't be starting that summer because behavioral complaints had been made against me and they didn't think I was fit to represent the university anymore.
I hope they didn't, redefine plagiarism either, right? Like Harvard.
Right.
I'm just quickly, what does misplace mean? I don't even know what that means.
I have no idea. So that's why I called. I had no idea what that means. I was like, what do you like? They're just like, they called it a pause. They're like, we just don't think you're fit to represent the university at this moment. So you can't continue with the internship. So of course I make all these phone calls. None of my major professors knew what the decision was, that had been made. And when I called my internship director, the interim, she couldn't give me a straight answer. And so then I took legal action. So I said that I hired a lawyer and that I was going to sue the university. And if they didn't, provide me with a meeting, give me additional explanation, that I was going to go further with this law case. And so wrap it up, had a meeting with the department chair, the dean. They finally got me a meeting. I sat down and we had that, when you like in the movies when like a kid's in detention and they have those big giant manila folders. Like, like the they bring it in. It's like the guidance counselor has a file, like this thick file.
You brought your file.
No, I came into the meeting and they had a thick file.
Oh.
And
This is the Jackie Kaminsky
they just
file.
throw it on the table. And I was just like, I'm done. Like, I go, I don't know what. And but I just sat there super calmly and I was like, please tell me, What are the allegations that have been brought against me? And all the complaints. So this professor for like 2 semesters was filing complaints against me, and it was never brought to my attention. So like I was never brought in to department chair, any professors. Like it was never, they never complained about my behavior. They never addressed me in an email. But all the complaints were that, from this one professor, and she said that I complained about a test grade. So she, printed out that email that I had sent her, and she attached it in that folder. She said I stopped showing up to class, which attendance wasn't mandatory, and I think we can all agree that, as adults, that we can decide if we're paying for something that we can decide to show up or not.
And this is the grad classes.
This is grad, yeah, this is a grad
Okay.
class.
Yeah.
She said that I spoke poorly about her in the hallway to another student, in which,
Ooh, oh my God.
yeah, so bad. In which I
And that's the
replied,
first time a student has ever spoken poorly
yeah.
about a professor.
And I kind of was just like, all right, well, where's your proof? Because that's, that's hearsay. Like, it's what she said, he said. And then finally, my favorite one was that I was playing with a girl's hair in class, and it was distracting.
Oh my. No wonder why the Seminoles lost by 60 points.
We have really great disciplinary, or disciplinary, I can even say that word,
Disciplinary actions.
disciplinary actions. Yes.
So, okay. You know what's interesting about this? I've been teaching. I actually started teaching when I was in grad school. And I've never once in my life, and I've been doing this for almost 3 decades, thought that I needed to report a student. It's just not anything that comes to them. Even if they're complete dicks or bitches or whatever, it's like, okay, there's always, students who are just asses or whatever. Maybe you don't get along, but I've never thought that. I mean, a professor, in my opinion, has to be really petty
Really
to
petty
do something like
sure
that.
with who they are to do, because it's just like, unless they're doing something that's just like, like plagiarism or cheating, where it's something like where it's grounds for expulsion, or if you're gonna say, hey, like you have to fail you, like this is just unacceptable, you're breaking the code of conduct. Like outside of that, I was just like, what? Like you just have an agenda,
Yeah, it sounds like a stupid personality conflict she has,
yeah. So
or maybe she just doesn't like you.
she definitely doesn't like me. That was, she made that very, so that was the best part of the story, was that after that meeting, they wanted me to write an apology letter to her. And then write her, oh, also, and write a reflective essay at the end of the summer. So I had to take the summer to think about my actions.
Oh, I'd be so annoyed.
I got put in adult timeout. And then, so then the best part of it was that I found her in the hallway shortly after that meeting. And I addressed her and I just said, listen, if we had our differences, or if I disrespected you in any way, I'm truly sorry. Can we move on from this? And she goes, I don't like you. I don't think I'll ever like you. If I have any advice, it's to lose the attitude issue. You have a serious attitude issue, and I don't accept your apology.
Sounds like someone else has the
Can
attitude.
I ask a quick question about Jack? This is a professor. About how old is this person? Around.
She had to be, I think she was like 28 or 29.
Okay, I'm gonna say, I mean, that
She was
she's
young.
acting younger than that, but.
Yeah, she was young. And so it was that moment where I kind of thought, oh, well, I'm unfit to represent the university, but this is how your professors speak to their
Right.
students. Understood. I'm this program makes so much sense to me, loud and clear. I got it. Reflective essay, done.
So they paused your studies, or I guess it was the final semester, but you eventually ended up graduating despite all of the, nonsense.
Yeah, so I started fall. I was reinstated in the fall to finish my internship. So, but I was on thin ice. So if, anything happened in internship or they got one complaint about me, yeah, I was getting kicked out. It was bye bye. So I had to be like on my best behavior. And there was one instance where I had, so part of my clinical rotations is that I had to present 2 case studies. And I've presented for your classes. Like I like to be engaging. I like to throw jokes in there. So my first case study that I presented was like, I think it was on the Whipple procedure, is something that you do with patients in the hospital. And so I remember I did a slide where I made a little joke in the beginning, and it was like, what comes first? Because it has to do with pancreatic cancer.
Right.
What comes first, the chicken or the egg? And it was like pancreatic cancer or something else.
Hey, people remember analogies.
Yeah, just to like break the ice. And so after that, she like basically failed me in the presentation, saying that it wasn't professional enough. So then the next time, you know, I did it, I'm like hands like this. I'm just like very astute and just, you know, speaking very like professionally and like, you know, educated.
Well, hey, I'm sorry, Tony.
No, but yet look at all those, somehow or another, look at all those credentials under, right next to her name. She made it, right?
I made it.
She's the LDN.
And I assume this former professor of yours has no idea what you're doing these days.
No, I do want to rub it in her face. I'd love to run into her.
Okay. What I found most fascinating about that story is that oftentimes the people who, the conventional wisdom, you know, sort of in academia, who might view you as a troublemaker, are often the ones that end up shining down the road. Because I had similar issues when I was a grad student, and especially when I was faculty. I've had those issues all, you know, throughout my entire career. But we love people who are skeptical. We love people who are, you know, who are mavericks, who are iconoclasts. Otherwise, everybody's saying the exact same shit to everybody else.
You got to ruffle some feathers. That's how we create, you know, we create more, you know, space within the field. We dive deeper into topics and we get, you know, alternative opinions. And I was just like, yeah, if everyone's saying the same thing, then there's something wrong. Like,
yeah, now you're in a field. Now, Tony and I, you know, we're a bit older than you. So we have seen things that I don't even think you were alive back. Wait, when were you born?
95.
Holy, Tony, do you realize she didn't even see the initial UFC fights? Do you realize that?
Yeah, she wasn't born yet. Yeah. 2 years. Born. 2 years. So wait, when's birthday again, Jack? You're in?
I'm December.
You're December. Yeah, you're. So it's November of 93. So 25 months.
Yeah.
UFC one. Jack joins us here on Planet Earth.
This is crazy. So, you know, I remember you and I remember watching Hoist Gracie and seeing this skinny guy who knew something called Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu dominating people. And I'm like, wow, this is the coolest thing ever. Just all these different styles of fighting. And then if we fast forward to 2023, you work with professional fighters of all sorts, whether it's MMA, you know, bare knuckle or whatnot. For most people, and I get this question a lot for students, they say, and Tony does as well, hey, I want to work with pro athletes. I'm like, okay, what kind of pro athletes? And oftentimes they say football because football is glamorous. I'm like,
yeah,
good luck. You're not working with football. A lot of that is who you know, and you got to be at the right place, right time. And you got to be willing to work for peanuts, you know, if you want to, you know, get with a pro team. But it is just as esoteric to work with pro fighters, because Tony can comment on this, at least in the boxing world, there tends to be more, I'm not sure what the word is, but because it's existed so much longer, there's more tradition and maybe a lot more, trying to think of the word, not superstition, but they will often do things based on what someone else told them to do, you know, years before.
It's ingrained in kind of like old practices, and it's just this unwillingness to change. And I don't, because I wouldn't call it clicky, even though it is, like, once they have their people, they're very, that's fight sports in general. Once they find their people, that's their people. Like, they're not gonna, you know, find a new coach or go somewhere else unless they lost, you know, had a devastating loss and they figured, okay, well, I need to, you know, switch things up.
So how did you transition into that? Because it's not something, this isn't a job that they teach you about in grad school. Yeah.
Fighting in general or the boxing part?
The fighting in general.
So that had a lot to do with that internship at the UFC. So that's, you know, at the time, I don't think there were many RDs that even touched fighting, just because it was a bit nuanced in the sense that it kind of goes against everything that you're taught. So it's just because it's extremely unhealthy, right? We're getting you to lose massive amounts of weight, crash diet, you know, all these acute weight loss practices to purposely dehydrate, like, you know, 8%, 10% of your body weight, like crazy stuff. So it's like, dietitians are like, I'm not going to touch that, you know, it makes no sense. So when I was at the UFC and I started working, so I was there with Clint when he was the director. And then I was also there when they had just hired Charles. So Charles was there probably like the last month I was there. So I learned a lot from him too, because he's the current director now. And it was their internship was still pretty new. So I got to do everything. So I was just, you know, I was doing the nutrition. I was doing the food ordering. I managed the smoothie bar. I did all the sports science testing. I got to hang out with Heather and physical therapy and watch her processes. I got to follow Bo and do all the strength conditioning. So I got to see like all the different parts of it. And after, you know, I made a lot of connections there. A lot of those fighters that I, you know, some of them that I'm still close friends with even today, a lot of them moved here to South Florida or they live down here. So when I moved back from school, I started working at Delray Beach Boxing, which they weren't really attracting, you know, professional athletes back then. It was under different management, but I just thought, oh, boxing gym might be a cool space to get into.
Jackie, sorry to interrupt. When you say working, meaning
like working front desk, I was front desk. Just, like okay. Just checking people into the gym. Okay.
Sometimes you got to start some, you got to start.
Somewhere. Yeah. So I just wanted to put myself in the space. I just thought, okay, well, if I want to work, cause after the UFC internship, it just really solidified my love for fighting. I thought this is such a niche market and similar to what you said earlier, everyone wants to get into the major sports, football, basketball, and baseball. And at the time, you know, every major sports team had a dietitian at the professional and collegiate level. Like you said, you got to be willing to work, you know, 70 hours a week for $20,000, $30,000 a year, yeah. Holidays, work yourself up through the ranks. And I was not interested in that. I go, where can I make it big really quick and really, like really fast? And I just, you know, no one touched fighting it. So I thought, oh, what a great niche to get into. South Florida has such a huge market for it. It's perfect.
It does. Yep.
Yeah. And then when I got into that boxing gym, I met Maureen Shea, who then introduced me to you guys at the first sports science conference. So
that was right here at Nova. I remember when we first met you here. Yep.
Yep. So after that, I decided to start my company in March of 2020. So COVID also helped with that because I had just graduated. No one was hiring, obviously, because the whole world was closed down. And I thought, well, I'm not going to wait around for the world to open. And it's pretty apparent that I cannot have a boss because I will get fired for misconduct or behavioral issues. So I'm just going to start my own thing. And I did.
Hey, you can't fire yourself, right?
Yeah, no, you can't. I can do whatever I want.
Well, you know, what's interesting is one, you don't see many women at all that have the kind of interest, I'll call it the sports science side, whether it's nutrition or strength and conditioning, that have an interest in the fight sports in general. So in a way you're sort of this, I don't know, black sheep or just you stand out because I would imagine, and Tony knows these numbers better, it's almost all men that work in that.
Yeah, it is. Fortunately, I think we're seeing it. More young women. I think, Jack, you're a great model for this because, like, I have young students that would like to consider this as a career, right? And the fact that really some hardcore dudes, whether it's in bare knuckle, or you work with women too, but you work with plenty of men in boxing, kickboxing, MMA. And I think the fact that they have full trust in you is really a good thing for the young women that want to consider strength and conditioning or doing these fight sports or doing the dietary side. And I try to inspire them to do so. I use you as an example often and say, hey, you know, she's been doing this for 3-4 years. So she's a very young woman at the time. And these athletes put trust in her. So, you know, this is, it's a very good to see. I'm not one who says, oh, we have to get more of this or more of that in it. But I think initially a lot of women were intimidated by it. Didn't feel as if they'd be respected. And that was one thing that pushed them away from it. I think now that there's a greater acceptance amongst really hardcore dudes to use women in discipline, in fight skill discipline too. Like, just take a look at Daria Albert, right? Daria does the mental skill. Daria does skill training. She does it all and a little bit of conditioning. So anyway, good point is you were one of certainly maybe the earliest on women doing this. And I think you're helping a lot of young women who aspire to it. Good work on that. Kind of gutsy, TFN.
Thank you.
So you're basically a trailblazer.
I am. I like to think so. That was you the should, goal when I got into it. Yeah.
I think you should text your former professor that. No, I'm just
kidding. Like, by the way, I'm like a big figure in this industry. Don't know. Kind of a big deal.
So tell the audience a little about this. Okay. So in dealing with male fighters and female fighters, and let's talk specifically about is the nutrition advice you give to both? I assume there are broad generalities that work for everyone, but once you start getting into the month prior to a fight, and then the 2 weeks and 1 weeks where, you know, you got to cut weight, how do you treat men and women differently if there is a sex difference, or you just know each fighter individually that well that you can't really go by just male and female?
I think to start, how you kind of mentioned, you can do a broad generalization, especially for sex cat, you know, for the different sexes. So like, you know, females typically can abide by a certain set of guidelines, males, and there's kind of a set in the middle that kind of works for everybody. Mm-hmm. But for me, it really is about the individual athlete. And after doing this for 4 years now, no matter what kind of guidelines you create that you want to start off with, every single person is so different. Mm-hmm. And especially, so the one thing with my females that I notice is especially different, especially as we get closer to the fight, is obviously it's just the menstrual cycle. So their female physiology, whether on they're on birth control, they're not on birth control, their age plays a huge factor. I have female athletes that are really young. I have female athletes that are old, like they're in their 40s and maybe they're hitting closer to that perimenopause phase. So there's so many changes that occur that require me to be more considerate of that and what's going on and have to dive into the research a little bit more. And even as I'm trying to find patterns, you know, within females in general, it is much more, there's a lot more intervariability. So every single one of them is different. I've yet to create a protocol where I'm like, oh yeah, across the board, this seems to work. It's like, nope, every single female is different.
Right. If you're doing weight cutting effectively, that's going to happen. You would look, practical application, linear prescription is wonderful. We try to draw some basic guidelines, but it's challenging. Right? Because that intervariability, there's behavioral factors outside of the physiology that impact it. It's a great challenge. And that's one thing I do appreciate about how you're doing it. You understand that it's not only is going to be the variables, it won't even just be intervariability between person to person. It will be between cut to cut sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I've had cuts with even my, you know, male athletes are much easier to deal with because they're easier to predict. We don't have all these extra variables, hormones, things like that that are maybe playing as much of a factor. But cuts, I've had cuts with certain male athletes that every single cut has been different.
Yeah, exactly.
Trying to utilize maybe different tactics to individualize the approach more. Some are successful, some aren't. And to your point, Tony, I think if you can control every single variable, the underlying factor is adherence, because I'm not with them.
Yes, you know, exactly.
I'm not always with them. I've had one fighter where, you know, I did spend an entire month with him in Vegas and I cooked I controlled everything that went in and out of his mouth. I mean, aside from the times that he admitted he woke up in the middle of the night and snuck into the pantry.
Cheater. He's a cheater.
Which I gave him a lot of shit for. But you know, after that fight, the weight cut, it was the best weight cut he ever had. His coach said it. I mean, he lost the fight, unfortunately. It was a really big fight, but it was the best camp that he's ever performed. Mm-hmm. And every camp that we've had after that, I haven't been with him, living with him in the house. You know, I've even cooked his meals, but I'm not there with him physically. And his adherence to consuming the food I want him to consume at the right times, you know, played a big role in that. And so for my athletes, I do most of my coaching is remote. So I'm not with them. So I can write the perfect plan, but exactly. If they're not adhering to it 100%, I can't control for that. And so that's going to play a big factor in how, you know, how effective my programming is and how, you know, easy or hard their weight cut is leading up to that, you know, leading up to that fight.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, not just with weight cuts, but diets in general, exercise in general, hell, life in general, adherence. You know, most people have a hard time sticking to whatever strategies or tactics they need to reach a goal. And it's, in a way, it's not that difficult. You just got to do what you're supposed to do. But a lot of people don't want to do that. Now, compare what you do with these fighters versus what you were taught in school. And this is a comparison I want you to make.
Good question.
There are ideas within the dietetics world about how you should eat. Okay. Compare and contrast that with sort of the general guidelines you give to fighters, not as part of a weight cut, but this is how you should eat. So what did you learn in school versus what you tell, let's use the broad category athletes, what you tell athletes to do?
Yeah. So Going through school, I mean, you're taught everything is spoken very vaguely. So you're taught about, you know, they use like the MyPlate a lot, using, you know, making sure you're always consuming complex carbohydrates, rich sources of proteins, healthy fats. And, you know, I feel like we never really got into specific guidelines. It was just a matter of discussing, you know, in clinical situations, what was required, if you had to change dietary needs based off of what a patient was experiencing, or more counseling, you know, how to talk people through what their struggles are, where you maybe there is, you know, some sort of block, or I'm trying to think, what's the word I'm trying to think? Like there's something preventing them from being able to adhere to a program, or if they have a fear of food. So it wasn't so much, you know, different. It's just really niche with the fighting. So especially in the sports realm, we talk about, you know, how carbs are good for endurance athletes, how to fuel with simple carbs for high intensity workouts, complex carbs, if they have longer duration workouts, can mix them in, how protein's really great for power athletes for maintaining lean mass, or for preserving tissue and calorie deficits, but nothing was ever discussed in terms of extreme circumstances. Mm-hmm. So that's where the fighting was really different in terms of what I had to practice and what I think is still maybe lacking a little bit in the research. Like I'd love to get into that at some point, you know, if I pursue my PhD, you know, we understand like low energy availability. That's studied because, I mean, you know, look at endurance athletes or these, you know, ultra marathoners, Ironmans, whoever, they just, the volume of training they do is so much that there's no way that they could eat that much food in a day to replace it. So they run into all these issues. But with fighting, it's, you know, maybe we see it in the bodybuilding community, but bodybuilding doesn't have that, I think, that volume and intensity that fighting does. So it's really playing with that, you know, energy restriction. Like what are the absolute limits that we can kind of bring someone down to before we're causing long-term issues, whether that's mentally, hormonally, physiologically, and in terms of their career and their performance.
Yeah. I know the ACSM guidelines, which I don't teach and I don't use, but I remember learning them way back when, you know, the only, in terms of rate of weight loss, you can lose safely 1 to 2 pounds a week. And that's that's what's ingrained in everyone. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows that is exposed to sports that 1 to 2 pounds a week.
Or they say the big one is 500 to 1,000 calorie deficit to lose weight. Mm-hmm. That's like the magic number. So that's, what you're taught. And you're like, well.
Not in this world. What about in terms of, I know there's always that discrepancy in terms of protein intake, athletes tending to consume a lot more than, you know, what typically is recommended by clinical nutritionists.
So clinical nutrition, I think they still push the 0.8 to 1 gram per kilo.
Even still.
Even, I mean, that was like what they taught in, you know, when I was in school, those were the guidelines. I think clinically, maybe up to 1.2. When we took a sports nutrition class, that's when they talked about higher intakes, especially among strength athletes or bodybuilders. But I think that is the biggest, I think that's just like the biggest gap in terms of what we see in the field for people who practice versus what's still being pushed from a national perspective, is that this whole thing that, oh, like we're going to emphasize higher carb intake or higher fat intake. And it's just like, okay, both of those, like over the years, have clearly caused problems with people. Look at like the trends in diets over the decades, like super low fat or super low carb. You know, what would we just say eat higher protein? That'll fix a lot of your problems. There's no issues associated with the high protein intake. Right.
But why do you think that gap or that discrepancy, it's existed since, put it this way, I did my undergrad and Tony, we're about the same age. In, you know, when Ronald Reagan was president, I don't know if you remember Ronald Reagan, Jackie.
I know who he is, but I don't know what he did.
So the only nutrition class I took as an undergrad, I remember the professor was an older, you know, older woman who said, you know, athletes that eat all this protein, it's bad for your kidneys. So it's not like this goes way back. And the fact that it still exists today is still
people really say it, yeah.
It's weird. I mean, don't you find it weird?
I think it's strange, especially when there's like, especially with Instagram and social media, and there's all these people showing how much protein they eat and all these researches and everyone coming out with like, no, like this is what you're supposed to do. And people are like, oh no, yeah, it's still bad. Like I still have clients who they're not fighters, they're not athletes, but I have clients who have gone to the doctor, they've gotten blood work, and you know, they'll report that their creatinine or some sort of level is high, and they immediately tell them, oh, you can't eat protein anymore. And I'm like, hey, well, like, were you working out before you got that done? Like, you know, what's going on here? You're working out a lot, like just high protein intake in general. I was like, that doesn't mean they're like, oh yeah, it's bad for your kidneys. Like doctors still say that.
Yeah. That's insane. That is just insane that, yeah, you have physicians that, but you know what? Hey, medicine, I mean, you've seen how medicine's been just absolutely insanely crazy in the last 3 years.
Oh, I think I'm going to become a doctor because it's super easy. You just talk to somebody, you listen to their problem, and then you go, here's an antibiotic.
Here's a pill.
Oh my God, I'll be the best doctor ever.
That's what like America that relies on. So
I'm not going to do any tests. I'm just going to look at you, antibiotic.
Yeah, that's the whole antibiotic thing. And, you know, we had that guest last year, Tony, talking about the gut microbiome, how important it is. And
Dr. Sarah. Yeah.
Yeah. And even though antibiotics were a great invention, I mean, certainly for dealing with bacterial infection, people don't realize there's always another side to these medicines. People think, oh, they're the greatest things in the world. I'm like, you never know down the road, you know, if there's issues related to it. And it brings me to the weight cutting. This is sort of a separate issue in terms of weight cutting. Do you know if athletes are using any of the GLP-1 agonists to help loop them lose weight, Ozempic or anything like that?
I haven't heard of it. No. I mean, I'm obviously it's probably illegal. So if they were to get tested and caught.
Tony, would that be illegal?
I don't think it's been considered yet. It probably will be.
Because Tony, insulin's not allowed. I remember when I was researching.
Right. So peptides are supposed to be out, right? Yeah. Growth, the BP, what is it? I don't know, BBC. I don't know much about peptides. I don't get into the whole drug thing because I don't. But nevertheless, there's only been rumored, Joey, so far. There's no knowledge of anybody really doing it. I am sure it's going to be considered, though. I'm sure it's going to be considered in wrestling. You know, at the higher levels, because when you have to lose weight, right? These guys are doing this over 3-4 months. They're not doing this for one fight.
No, and they're doing it on a weekly basis.
Exactly. So I would assume that those are going to be considered, and probably there's probably some use in the sport right now. But again, what would it do? It would mitigate appetite and delay gastric emptying, which, by the way, isn't all that good for your weight to begin with. You know,
and so you run the risk of your stomach getting paralyzed. Have you seen those articles?
Yeah, apparently now some of the side effects, I guess, after 6 months to 1 year of use are starting to develop now, you know. But to date, I'm not familiar with anybody discussing it, but I know it's been a concern. There's been a lot of people bringing that up, and will this be a part of weight cutting soon?
I mean, what is it? Weight cutting itself isn't exactly the healthiest behavior. So,
no.
I mean, whether or not these drugs on top of that make it more unhealthy, in a way, is kind of a weird point to make because the entire process isn't healthy. I mean, competitive athletics isn't healthy.
I think the entire process isn't healthy. I think most of them, you know, they already engage in practices like they take diuretics, they do enemas, they already do all these sorts of things to help lose massive amounts of weight. And I just think that the more you add, and just again, you're adding more variables to something that's already sensitive. It's just like, I think you're just going to further mess up the process. And if something goes wrong or you end up in the hospital, you have no idea what contributed to it because now you're adding all these additional things that you really probably shouldn't.
No, that's a great point, Jackie, because really the first goal isn't even do no harm in weight cutting. It's try to stop things from going wrong.
Yeah.
Before we even try to do anything right, the first goal is first stop everything from going wrong. And by just adding more drugs, right? And more, you've you've opened up the propensity or possibility for greater side effects and greater malfunction. So you're spot on there.
But then you're introducing that into situations where there's most of the people when they're doing a weight cut, their team members don't have any medical backgrounds.
True. Yeah.
So they don't know what to do if someone passes out or faints, or if they feel like, you know, they're not tracking, you know, they're not like us. They're not tracking blood pressure and heart rate and all these metrics. So you're dealing with people who are just, that seems normal, or I don't know if that seems normal or not. And you're like, okay, awesome. This is a great game that we're playing. The blind leading the blind.
Hey, if it works for one person, hey, maybe it works for another person, right?
Maybe.
hey, we're at the tail end of the podcast. I want to delve into supplements. So what are some of the typical supplements that you would recommend for fighters? Is it different for men and women? Would it be different as they approach the weight cut? Obviously, you know, as with things like creatine, et cetera, et cetera. What are your thoughts on that?
So my top one lately has been astaxanthin. I'm obsessed with it.
Really?
Yes, I love it. Ever since it was Karen Hacked presented it at ISSN, and I talked to her. I use it with all my athletes. I'm not testing blood markers, so I don't know what's going on, but I've gotten really great feedback from all of my athletes in terms of recovery, things like that. And for me, recovery is the most important aspect with working with fighters. I think any athlete in general, because that's the one part that they never focus on. They're go, 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 go. And they're not going to stop, even if you tell them. So recovery is my main part.
Yeah, just quickly, can you tell everyone what are you using that for primarily?
It's for recovery. So it's to help with muscle soreness.
Soreness, okay.
Help increase energy. I've heard some people say it helps them sleep better, but it's essentially at the cellular level, it's explained that it helps fight reactive oxygen species. So just any sort of inflammation, especially from exercise, can reduce CRP levels. So again, just muscle recovery.
Okay.
So again,
and quell many of the inflammatory cascades too, potentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And then immunity. It's a really great immune booster.
Okay, good.
So that's a big one. I love creatine, but I use it sparingly. It's a case by case situation. I have like one guy, for example, if he takes creatine today, he puts on 30 pounds tomorrow. So there's like where he is not allowed to touch it at all. He did it like unknowingly. He told me his weight bumped up. He was like 190. And then like a week later, he was like 200 pounds. I go, what the heck happened to you? Because my wife like mixed the creatine with the protein powder. And I had no idea that it was in there. And I was like, oh my God.
I know that people who know creatine so well don't believe that. When I did 10 grams for 1 week, I was almost 11 pounds heavier.
Yeah, no, I was
already doing 5, but then I went to 10 and I went 11 pounds.
Yeah, but Tony, you were strong as shit.
I put on like 8 pounds.
Oh, I was using, I don't even lift weights. I was using 120 pound dumbbells like they were rattles. I was walking around with them. I was strong.
Like shake weights. yeah, you know what? That by itself would be an interesting study, that there are hyper responders to creatine.
Yeah.
That would be.
But yeah, so obviously that guy, stay away from creatine. What else?
Creatine, beta alanine.
Love it.
Again, love it. I just think from a performance standpoint, just allows them to maintain that, you know, high anaerobic capacity a little bit longer, that explosiveness. And then other than that, it'll just be a probiotic, just again, the gut health aspect. I think with everything that they're eating, especially if they're taking supplements or they're not, you know, they consume a lot of sport-based snacks, I don't think they're always great for your gut health. And I'm really big on how that influences mind health, recovery, everything. And if it's not that, then it's just like a general multivitamin. So vitamin D, probably the biggest one out of all those, because they're inside all the time. And we know how much that influences immunity, muscle growth, things like that. So those would be like my top ones.
Do you give specific recommendations for carbs, fat, protein in terms of grams consumed per kilo, or they don't worry about it? You just say, this is what you got to do.
So how my plans work when I meal plan for them, I don't like anyone to count calories or grams of carbs, because they're also not going to.
Right.
They're not all of them. I love all of them, but they're not always like the brightest bulbs, you know, like in the tanning bed. Sure, I was in the dryer.
So you do the counting.
I do, yeah. I do all the, you know, the work on the back end. I plug in all the numbers, I do the ranges, and then I just translate that into food. And I just say, you need to eat this for breakfast, this is your pre-workout, this for lunch, dinner, et cetera, in exact amounts. If you get this, then I know that you're staying within the range that I kind of need you to be in.
So you simplify it, you dummy it down.
I literally, like, as stupid as possible. Like,
like eat two eggs there, or something. Though.
They don't want to count, right?
They don't want to count. They don't want to think about it. I talk to all of them. Like, I think of every fighter is that they're like my eight-year-old little sister. If she can't understand it, they're not going to understand it.
So you run it by your sister. that's too funny.
You're
all right, so I'm sorry,
on, I'm sorry. No, but you're using some protein where needed, Jackie, or no?
I love protein powder. I use all the time. I don't really consider that a supplement anymore.
No, I agree with you.
Like across the board, that's just like, you know, protein is protein. If we need to get it in, get it in. Preferably from food, but you know, some of them with the convenience, you know, a smoothie, just protein powder and water after practice is easiest. So
yeah, the drinks are so good for those the men and women who have the multiple sessions on a daily basis too, right? I mean, just to get in some quick protein and, you know, that's what I use it for in between sessions.
Yeah, but if I'm being honest, I'm not big on this, like too many supplements. Like I just like to implement the ones that I think will 100% work. So that would be like my astaxanthin, the creatine, the beta alanine. Everything else, I rather them get it through food. I don't like to rely on so many powders and pills and have them take like a pharmacy, like a CVS pharmacy every single morning before they go train. Just because I think the adherence would be really low. And I think it's just better if they can actually consume it in whole foods. They'll be more satisfied.
Yeah, I always think out of all the supplements, particularly because of the energy systems, you know, that involved in MMA, I always thought beta alanine is probably one of the best. Mainly because you produce so much. I mean, the glycolysis and the hydrogen ions you produce, beta alanine, or even, well, what's funny, sodium bicarb probably works as well, but nobody uses sodium bicarbonate, I guess, because of GI distress.
It's brutal to keep down.
Yeah. So
actually, if you could use baking soda, if they just took like spoonfuls of baking soda.
I know. I've tried it. It's like, I cannot stomach baking
soda. That sounds really gross.
Like, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really bad. I've tried it.
Oh God, why?
Many years ago, but not.
Well, Jackie, we're towards the end. Tell the audience where they can find you if they need to find you on Instagram or Twitter or whatever. And if you, other than ISSN, which is in June, if you're going to be giving any talks or seminars and what?
No seminars, but you can find me on Instagram at The Fight Nutritionist. That's where I'm most active. And I have a website, fightnutritionist.com. You can find me there. And as of recently, I'm launching something called Fight Club. It is modeled after the movie.
Okay.
So it's called Fight Club. It's for non-fighters. It's for people who are, you know, regular individuals, but they train like athletes and they just need, you know, some more direction because they're still not able to meet their goals. But, you know, they're motivated individuals. They want to learn more about nutrition, maybe get a good strength conditioning program and get access to one-on-one coaching, but, you know, don't want to pay the one-on-one price. So
where will the Fight Club be held? I assume that you still got to fight.
No. So it's not actual fighting. We're just modeling after Fight Club. But the link is on my website. I have a whole landing page. We're going to start mid-February, beginning of March, capping it at 20 people. But whoever the winner is, they will be